Palestinian director Yusuf Saroughi discovered family videos that his mother made during the Second Intifada. He turned that footage into his documentary, Three Promises. I'm Tom Powers, and this is Pure Nonfiction. Yusuf Saroughi was just a boy in 2000 when fighting intensified between Israelis and Palestinians for what became known as the Second Intifada. He was living with his parents and older sister in the town of Beit Jaffa, near Bethlehem. When fighting broke out, his family would take refuge in their basement. Sometimes it didn't feel safe enough from gunfire and explosions. Yusuf's mother, Suha, an architect, would frequently use a camcorder to videotape the family. It wasn't until Yusuf was an adult that he realized those tapes existed. While going to graduate school in California, he met his producer, Marielle Olentine, who helped guide the project, along with other collaborators, to become Three Promises. The film debuted last spring at the Switzerland festival Visions du Real. It made its U.S. premiere in September at the Camden Film Festival, where it won the main jury prize. That was just a few weeks before war escalated with the Hamas attack on October 7th, followed by Israel's invasion of Gaza. Now Three Promises has a theatrical run in New York at the DC TV Firehouse Cinema. Yusuf lives on the West Bank in Ramallah. That's where I reached him by Zoom. I started by asking him to describe his family's history.
I mean, my family goes way back. You know, my grandfather was an archivist himself, and from my dad's side of the family, Saroughi, and he actually has documented our family's presence in Nazareth for about 500 years, if not a bit longer. And that's actually available on Saroughifamily.com or something like that, the whole family tree. So, you know, we're my dad's side of the family is from Nazareth. I was born there, and which is today in Israel. It's a Palestinian city in Israel. So being born there, I have a Palestinian Israeli citizenship. My mother, on the other hand, she's from the West Bank. She's from Beit Jala, this little town outside of Bethlehem. They also have been there for a lot longer. My grandmother on my mother's side is a refugee from 48. She was originally from Ramle, which is a town just outside Jaffa, which is now known as Tel Aviv. So, you know, all sides of my history are from different parts of historic Palestine. And yeah, at the age of three, just around when the Oslo Accords were happening in the mid-90s, my parents got excited and thought we should move to Beit Jala, back to the West Bank, because there was a lot of promise and hope and that things were going to be better and the Palestinian state was about to get recognized. And that's what happened. We moved there a few years later, in September 2000, the Second Intifada started, and that's kind of where my film, most of the film's material starts as well. That's an overview of the history, I think.
Can you describe for people who haven't seen the film what your family's experience was during the Second Intifada?
Sure, yeah. So for those who haven't seen the film is made up mostly of archival footage that my mom filmed during the Second Intifada. And what we would do essentially was, you know, during the day, it was just normal life, you know, from a child's perspective, at least. I'm sure the news was, as we imagine it, as we see it today, there are things happening in the news. But the day-to-day life on the ground, I'd go to school, I'd play with kids from the neighborhood on the street during the day. And then suddenly you'd hear gunshots or, you know, a tank would come into the neighborhood and we'd have to run inside, everyone run back home. And at that point, you know, the family would be surrounding the TV or the radio, listening to the latest updates, also hearing how far away the shots are being fired. And at certain points when it feels like it's getting close and our life is being threatened, we lived in an apartment, so we would go to the staircase to the joint staircase, and we would go to the bottom of the staircase, which was partially underground. And we would, my parents had set up a mattress there, a little electric heater because it was cold, and we would spend the nights there. My dad would read Harry Potter to me and my sister. That's how I learned how to speak English. And I would, he would take us to, you know, another world so we could breathe a little bit. And in other times we moved around when our neighborhood got really intense and dangerous. We would stay at my grandparents' house, who also had a basement in the underground. We would stay there. And at some point we also stayed at an abandoned school in Bethlehem because Beit Jalla was getting, it was getting too intense. Bethlehem was quieter, so my mom found us a place to stay in Bethlehem, which was just classrooms.
In the title, Three Promises, can you describe what that refers to?
You know, throughout the film I and the creation of the film, I had multiple conversations with my mom, and I recorded those, asking her about her memories and her feelings and how she dealt with the situation from her perspective. And we found, through those conversations, we found a nice way to structure the film around these conversations that my mom would have with God. And, you know, she claims, which I believe, we are not really a religious family. I didn't grow up knowing I was Christian. I didn't even know the difference between a Christian and a Muslim. I grew up Palestinian, first and foremost. And yeah, but as my mom would say, when push comes to shove, when, you know, when you're back against the wall and you feel like no one is listening to you as a Palestinian, the news aren't covering what's happening, your friends are all busy dealing with their own situation, my mom felt like she didn't have a choice but to speak to God. And what she would do is, in these moments of great need and she's really fearing for me and my sister's life, she would talk to God and she would negotiate with God, as she would put it. She would say, if you help me and my kids get out of this situation alive, I promise I'll take my kids and leave. And, you know, as I mentioned, we have Israeli citizenship, so we have the capability to leave. Many of our friends and family do not, did not, and still do not. But, you know, with that being said, the next day my mom would change her mind. Because, you know, during the day, life is kind of back to normal. We're back in the streets. You know, she would fall back in love with her town and her community, and she would renegotiate with God. So the film is essentially structured around three moments where this happens. And in the last and final moment is when she keeps her promise.
So ultimately, the third promise, she had lived through too many harrowing situations for the safety of her family, and she and your father ultimately decide to take the family and leave, and you moved to Qatar. Is that correct?
We initially moved to Jerusalem for a few months, and then from Jerusalem to Qatar.
And what was that experience like for you to leave? And how old were you then?
I was just about 10 years old. I was still young. People ask me about how the Intifada affected my my mental health and things like that. My answer is usually actually the move to Qatar affected my mental health more than the actual living under the bombing. Because for those who don't know, Qatar in 2003 wasn't what Qatar is today. It was still a lot smaller, but it was very much booming, a booming economy. They had their oil business, their natural gas, and they were building a new modern city. There was a lot of wealth and projects and development happening. So to have that juxtaposition as a child, going from, you know, hiding under staircases from bombs to attending school with Qatari royalty who are showing up to school in Rolls Royces and Range Rovers, and but they're speaking the same language and, you know, similar culture, relatively similar culture. It was a real shock for me as a child, and I it took me years to really process all of that.
So your mom had been taking these videotapes during the time on we watch in the film, the family is frequently going to the basement at night when there's shooting outside. And in the film, it comes across that that she had kept these tapes to herself or hidden for 15 years before you got to see them. Can you talk about what her motivations were to not share these tapes and how you came to realize that they existed and what that was like?
Yeah, I mean, it's very much the truth, actually. So 2018, 15 years after we left Bejala, I was in California doing my master's program, which is where I met Marielle, my producer. And, you know, through my friendship with Marielle, she was asking me questions about my time in the Intifada, and that brought up some of my memories and brought up some questions that I had for my parents, especially for my dad, because I don't necessarily remember how my dad reacted to the situation. My mom is a very vocal, very strong presence. She's difficult to forget. But as a child, I don't really remember how my dad was reacting. And as a growing young man, I was curious as to how, you know, I was nearing the age that my father was at that time, you know, so I was curious. And I went back to visit them in Christmas. We were out having dinner, and I asked my father, I'm like, you know, how, I don't remember what you were like, how did you feel during that time? And he didn't necessarily give me a straight answer, and instead was, oh, there's actually footage from that time. And that took me completely off guard. I was shocked. I'm like, what? And my mom was not happy initially that he mentioned that. He's like, why'd you tell him that? So I was like, whoa, as soon as we're getting home, we're getting this footage out and we're watching it. And thankfully, my dad, like his father before him, also an archivist, he had already digitized all of that footage. So as soon as we got home, put in the DVDs and watched it. And just from the first 5 minutes, you know, the first 5 minutes I saw were of, for those who haven't seen the film, or I apologize, but it was that scene where me and my sister are looking at the photographs that my mom took while we were sitting in the abandoned school on the mattress. And I was just completely shocked that this existed, because I remember these images, but I had reached a point where I was questioning my own memories, you know, like I was wondering if I made these up. But I immediately felt a sense of obligation to do something with it and to share that story.
And given that your mom had been holding these images back, what was her attitude towards you turning them into a film?
As soon as we watched the footage, my mom started crying, like not even 10 seconds into the pressing play. She immediately started crying, and I comforted her, and I'm like, Mom, it's okay. Like, me and Dima, we're adults now. Like, we've dealt with it. Like, it's fine. It's a part of our history. Like, there's no reason to, you know, feel this much pain. And I asked her, I told her, I'm going to take them. I'm going to see what I can do. She said, okay. 6 months, 7 months later, after working quite hard, me and Marielle, on it, we got our first fellowship from SF Film, the Catapult Filmmaker Fellowship. And at that point, we were like, okay, this is getting real. So I call up my mom. I'm like, Mom, we got this fellowship. And she's like, are you serious? I'm like, yeah. She's like, oh, I thought you were joking. I didn't know you were going to actually make a movie about it. I was like, no, it's happening. She's like, okay, good luck. And then, you know, later on in the process, in those conversations with her, I asked her, I'm like, Mom, why didn't you share this with us? And I mean, she gave me multiple answers, but to summarize, there was a sense of guilt that my mother was carrying. She felt that she was a bad mother. She was being a bad mother for keeping us there for so long when we could have left earlier. But then she would contradict herself and say, oh, but if we left earlier, it would have hurt more. And it's like, yeah, I mean, there's truth to both things. But in essence, she really felt guilty about that. And then she would also say, oh, you guys never brought it up. You never asked that the footage exists. I'm like, how am I supposed to remember, Mom? I was 7, 8 years old. But yeah, so, and then in that conversation, I asked her, I'm like, so how do you feel about me making the film? And she's like, I'm not sure. Like, she didn't want to come off as a bad mother. She's like, I'll come off as a bad mother. I'm like, no, you don't. You come off as an amazing person. And I'm like, you're not a bad mother. And then I asked her, I'm like, why did you film? Like, why were you filming at that time? And she said, she just went quiet and said, you know, I was hoping that maybe one day we could show the world. And I told her, well, that day has come.
Years later, in your 20s, you and your sister Dima moved back to Palestine. Can you talk to me about that decision?
I had just graduated with an economics degree from Vancouver, Canada at the time. It was 2016, 2017. And I got an internship at a hedge fund in New York. And I hated my life. I was not enjoying it at all. You know, the pay was good. You know, I was super, super lucky to have such an opportunity straight out of college. So I took that opportunity. But once the internship ended, you know, I spoke to the team there and I was like, I need to go back home. And the guy completely understood. And I called up my parents and I'm going back to Palestine. They're like, why? I'm like, I don't know. They're like, what are you going to do? I'm like, I don't know. I'll figure it out. But I just had this urge. I wanted to reconnect. I had been a stranger in Qatar. I had been a stranger in Vancouver. And I just felt like I needed to go back to whatever home is to establish that connection. And that's what I did. And as soon as my sister found out that I was going back, she's 3 years older, so she was already working. She was in Italy at the time. She heard I was coming back, and she's like, oh, if you're going back, I'm going back. So we came back together. And she didn't last as long as I did, though. She moved out a couple of years ago.
And so what was that reconnecting like for you?
You know, it's still ongoing, you know, some 8 years later. But it was beautiful. I've been fortunate enough to live in very comfortable cities like Doha, like Vancouver, like the Bay Area. And I just never felt comfortable, like neither physically nor emotionally. And I never really understood why, until I moved back here. And just that sense of belonging, that sense of connection to the physical land and the landscape and the weather and most importantly, really the community. I mean, even without people knowing who you are here, you feel like people know you, right? Mm-hmm. And they know me, they understand me at a deeper level. We're all facing the same struggle, no matter what social class we're from, no matter what religious class we're from. We're all Palestinian, and that's really something that connects us on a really deep level. And, you know, despite, it's not easy living here, you know, as you can imagine. But despite that, I'm grateful for the privilege to be able to live here and have it a little bit easier than most people. But my heart just feels more comfortable. Yeah, for all those reasons.
And I mean, you said when you went back, you didn't know what you were going to do. You know, what have you made your life around there?
Yeah, so I had come back, you know, with a degree in economics, and I just wanted to give back one way or another. I managed to get a job at an NGO, a non-governmental organization that worked with renewable energy and wastewater treatment and, you know, WASH. So I really enjoyed doing that kind of work with marginalized communities, access to water and access to energy and things like that. So then that led me to do the master's that I did in California in Berkeley, which was a master's of development practice, which is essentially development economics and sustainability and kind of this holistic approach to development. And since then, you know, that's when I started working on the film. So the film became like a side quest in my life that I had to, like a side mission for the video gamers. And, you know, I was doing that. But meanwhile, I moved back to Palestine after my master's. I was freelance consulting with NGOs on similar types of projects, socioeconomic things like that. And then I found a group of individuals here that have a similar view of life and similar goals, and they had started their own consulting company and venture builder, and So I joined that team and I've been with them for about 4 years now. And, you know, we're a bunch of 30-ish year old Palestinians who are trying to kind of build systems for equitable progress within Palestine and despite the occupation, of course, while also trying to fight the occupation in our own way. So yeah, it's been a really beautiful journey to have and you know, and I'm so lucky to have a fantastic team, both on the film team and the work team that I have here.
Do you think of yourself as a economist who happened to make a film, or a person who's in a way has two parallel careers as an economist and a filmmaker? How do you think of yourself?
I like to use the term accidental filmmaker. You know, I've loved film my whole life, and having the opportunity to dip my toes into the industry was fantastic. But to be honest with you, Tom, that was exhausting. Like power to every single filmmaker out there. Like, I don't know how you guys do it. If it was my sole source of income, I think I would have gone crazy 5 years ago. I would have lost it. So it's a very difficult industry. And I now appreciate it even more because of that. And I hope to one day dip my feet back into it. But right now my focus is on my main mission, on you know, freeing my people in one way or another. And how I think of myself, I'd like to think that, yeah, a lot of my accomplishments in life have been accidental. And not to say that I haven't tried, but you know, they say you create your own luck or whatever it may be, but you know, I'm super grateful for whatever energies there are that are helping me achieve the things that I'm doing and the people around me as well. So I would describe myself as just a philosopher. I like to think someone who wants open to new experiences, open to new knowledge, and doing my best to achieve, to find the answers that I can.
Three Promises premiered last spring in Europe, and then had its first U.S. Premiere at the Camden Film Festival in September, where it won an award, and you had other screenings in the U.S. Coming up, including at Doc NYC in November. My understanding was that you were going to be planning to attend more screenings, and then October 7th happened, and you went back to Ramallah because you wanted to be there. Can you talk about that decision?
Yeah, I mean, it was actually coincidental. Again, I was in the States for the Camden International Film Festival, which I believe was in September, if I'm not mistaken. And I had some work to do in Jordan, so I traveled back to Jordan. And on October 6th, I crossed the bridge over from Jordan into Palestine. I woke up the next day and this, like, you know, what is going on? Like, what is happening? But I decided to stay because, you know, part of the reason I moved back was to rebuild this community. And you know, what does that say about community if the second, you know, things hit the fan, you get up and leave, right? That the strength of community is shown in times of crisis, right? And I really wanted to be here to not let my friends down, not let my team down, even though they probably wouldn't have missed me that much. But you know, it was more for me than anything. And yeah, I wasn't able to make it to Doc NYC or IDFA or a few more actually that were happening in October and November. We were supposed to play at Cairo International Film Festival. That got canceled and postponed indefinitely. But thankfully, I had my team out in the States, Marielle, my producer, Mahdot, my editor, and Zane, the co-producer, who were able to attend those. And I got to live it through them, especially the Doc NYC experience. I think that was a beautiful experience because it was, people were out in the streets protesting and the film was happening at the same time. And it was just to see that solidarity from a distance, was it really touched my heart. It was beautiful.
Since October 7th, watching from the outside, media attention has understandably largely been focused on what's happening in Gaza. But what has the political climate and the state of the conflict meant for life in Ramallah?
Unfortunately, 2023, even pre-October 7, was a tough year in the West Bank in terms of violence from the Israeli illegal settlers. There were what Haaretz and other Israeli news agencies would call pogroms happening against Palestinian villages, where Israeli settlers would go in, destroy property, burn cars, burn houses, to try and, get people to leave these little villages. And, it's really hard to understand and to grasp, but if you were to look at a map, the villages they choose is not necessarily coincidental. I mean, they're trying to annex parts of the West Bank, and they want geographic continuity between the illegal settlements. And if there's an Arab village that comes between two illegal settlements, that Arab village is a thorn. We want to get rid of it. So unfortunately, that's been happening throughout 2023. And then once October 7th happened, there was a lot of fear. There was a lot of fear that the Israeli military would let the settlers loose on people in the West Bank. And people were on edge for a very long time. Still are, a bit less so now. Anyway, the violence did continue at the same rate. It didn't really increase that much. But what the Israeli military did do in Ramallah, and to explain this as quickly and concisely as I can, Ramallah is surrounded by either the separation barrier, the apartheid wall, whatever you want to call it, and settlements and Israeli infrastructure for the settlements. And if you were to enter or leave Ramallah, there are about 5 entrances. Imagine them like exits on a freeway in the States where you want to enter your town, right? There are 5 ones that surround the Ramallah, and you can enter and exit if you want to go anywhere, either into Jerusalem, into Israel, into Jordan, or to any other Palestinian city in the West Bank. You have to use these entrances and exits. And what they've done, they've closed 4 out of the 5 entrances and exits, completely closed, barricaded off, with soldiers present there. So now, and people who live in Ramallah, there's a lot of people who live outside of Ramallah and come to work in Ramallah and vice versa. And you have people who go to Jerusalem every day. And there's only 1 entrance and exit, which is a 1-lane road. And then there's a checkpoint with the military, and it takes hours to pass. So they've sieged Ramallah, just like they've sieged every other. They do this with every major city in the West Bank. So Nablus, Hebron, Jericho, Ramallah, Bethlehem, etc. They're all sieged, and they will open and close these entryways at their own will. So you don't really have a heads up. So you don't know if you have to be at work at 9 o'clock in Ramallah, you have no idea what time to leave. Because it could be 5 hours, it could be 2 hours, it could be 45 minutes. So it's been rough like that. But I mean, the community has been strong. People were scared, but they are hopeful on the streets, and you can feel it. And we do, and this is very important, I'm sure, for your listeners as well. We are keeping track of what's happening in the States and globally with the protests. I mean, when I would go into the office in the morning, one of the first things we would discuss would be like, oh, did you see that protest? Did you see, DC? Did you see New York? Did you see Berlin? Did you see whatever, London or whatever it may be? And it has been like actually awesome, quite literally awesome. And it's beautiful. I mean, what's happening in the universities today in the States, it brings me to tears, really, from just like, even if it's hopeless, even if nothing ever changes, just the fact that the tide has shifted and we feel seen and supported by young people all over the world, people from different shapes and colors and backgrounds and ethnics and ethnicities, it's really, really beautiful. And that gives us hope.
I want to ask you about the history of Palestinian filmmaking, which you've now contributed to. And I wonder, before you made this film, if there were Palestinian films that had special meaning for you, or how you regarded in general the representation of Palestinians in cinemas, some of which comes from outside filmmakers, some of which comes from the inside.
Outside filmmakers, that is few and far between good representations of Palestinians. I mean, maybe in the last 10 years or so has gotten better thanks to a few big names like Rami Youssef and Mo'amer and you know, people who are doing the work for the Arab minority in general, not just Palestinians. But, you know, like you say that, and I remember there was one Palestinian character on an American TV show who was Abed from Community. I don't know if you know the show. Yeah, and they had randomly made him Palestinian. There was absolutely no politicization of his character or anything at all. And I loved that show, and Chevy Chase was, you know, I enjoyed watching his work. And just that was like, why is Abed Palestinian? And him not being a terrorist, just being a quirky filmmaker who's, you know, I was like, wow, okay, this is amazing. Like, you know, whoever's in the writer's room is like, thank you, you know, thank you for doing that. But Palestinian film to me is really about films made by Palestinians. And to me, there is a rich history there. Maybe doesn't go too far back, but people like Ilya Suleiman, some of his films are my favorite films. Like, his latest is This Must Be Heaven. That's a film that speaks to me on so many levels. Not only is he from Nazareth, he understands the character of Nazareth and the characters that it breeds. And also Hani Abu Asad, who started with Palestinian films, he got an Oscar, first Palestinian Oscar nomination with his film Omar. And then he went on to do Hollywood films as well. And then you have others like Najwa Najjar, and then you have some really powerful documentaries, that one of which really helped me think about how I'm going to make my documentary, which is Five Broken Cameras, which you might have heard of, which was also about the Second Intifada. It was about a man, a journalist, and his family, and he would film the Israeli military coming to the village, and the film was structured around his five cameras that were broken by the military for different purposes. So that was beautiful. Another one is The Wanted 18, which I think I wish there was more like this, which is a documentary, animated documentary, using the like clay animation, a claymation or whatever. And it's about the first Intifada in the late 80s, early 90s, which was very much a nonviolent resistance, and, you know, Palestinians were boycotting Israeli products, one of which was milk, right? So this village, Beit Sahur, they decided to buy some cows from an Israeli settlers. They bought 18 cows and started milking the cows and sending milk over to people in the village. And then the Israeli military claimed that these cows were a threat to national security. And so the film kind of follows that process, and they managed to also interview the generals from the Israeli military who was in charge at the time. And it was just a beautiful, absurd, you know, take on the story. And to me, I love absurdity, I love dark humor. I think there needs to be a bit more of that in showcasing the Palestinian story, because I think people can connect with that rather than just having like a documenting story or just some dramatized, you know, we're suffering, help us. Life is more complex. Yeah.
The Wanted 18 definitely benefits from having a sense of humor and becomes accessible in a way that other films might not be. You described that your grandfather was an archivist. Your father has archiving sensibilities. And I've read that you're seeking to build a Palestinian film archive. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, sure. So the idea came early on when me and Marielle were considering looking at news archives to use in the film. And then once I started, publicly looking for other archival material to use, I had people come up to me and say, oh, my father was also filming, my uncle was filming, my neighbor was filming during that time. And I realized there's a lot of footage out there that's not being used, and it's probably just collecting dust. And it's a shame because...
Or deteriorating,
correct, yeah. And it's a real shame because the news archive practically doesn't exist. I mean, we spent years looking for like usable material from news archive. We found about 15 minutes from the AP and about 30 minutes from the French press, the French Associated Press. And it's mostly like, doesn't really paint a real picture of what was happening at the time. I reached out to Al Jazeera Arabic, who said that their archives from the Second Intifada were in Gaza. And for those who don't know, what's happening in Gaza today isn't the first time it happens. The Al Jazeera offices in Gaza have regularly been a target of the Israeli military, and those archives are most likely long gone. So this idea came of, well, as Palestinians and as people living in a war zone, we all know the reality that the reality on the ground isn't being correctly recorded in the histories and in the news and the media of the world. So why not have a place that is dedicated for first-person archival footage from moments in history and in cultures that didn't get the attention that it deserves? And the idea is to have it on there and to have it accessible to other filmmakers who want to use it. They could request some footage, and then whoever uploaded the footage can approve that request or decline it. Just so it doesn't go to waste, doesn't get lost.
Thinking about some of the universal themes in your film, obviously there are things that are very specific to the experience of living on the West Bank, but there's also this conversation taking place between a son and his mother that brings up themes that many of us can relate to, either as children or as parents. There's always a fear as a parent that you haven't done something correctly, that you made choices that let down your children. And you described how potent that was for your mother, and being able to have a dialogue about that across generations is not always an easy thing to do. So I wonder what you have learned from having those conversations with your mother.
I've learned a lot. I mean, I started to understand my mom on a much deeper level, and more as an equal in a way. You know, it humanized my mom. It brought her from this godly image as you have as of your parents as a child, these all-knowing beings, to really a human being who in many ways has the same insecurities and the same issues that I do, right? And so seeing her in this perspective really helped me see myself in many ways. And it also gave me hope for myself, to help me get out of my hole, because if she could make it and I'm in a better position because of her, the effort that she put in, than she was when she was my age. So then, I mean, I'm going to make it too, you know, and like hopefully make it better as well, you know, to develop on the work that her and my father had already put in. So there was really I felt a lot of growth, at least for me personally, and in the relationship between me and my mother, even my father and my sister. The whole family dynamic was affected in some ways. I can't really speak on their behalf, but from my perspective, it seems that way. And what I also learned about getting someone like my mother to speak, this might be relevant for other filmmakers as well, is I really got a lot of the golden stuff, the real like emotional, real storytelling, when I told her how to set up the recording equipment. I sent her a link of the footage that I wanted her to see, a list of very broad questions. And I told her, Mom, just put yourself in a room and just talk. I wasn't there. No one else was there. So that really helped her open up. And so she was speaking to me. She was kind of like a diary. So she was speaking to me and my sister, even though we're not there, but allowed her to be more vulnerable, because my mom is a very strong character, very hard to crack. And I, in other iterations of my sit down conversations with her, I'd be like, "Mom, stop it. Like, just let me in. Like, you know, just like, come on. You opened up before. Like, I know you can do it." And then another thing is always keep the camera rolling. I mean, I caught a lot of things. That last scene, that last footage, that was by accident. I was just like playing with the settings in the camera. And then I sensed my mom about to say something slightly more emotional than she usually. So I was like, okay, yeah, I need to straighten the camera quickly. All right, okay. And then I got her to go. But yeah, it's really these moments of, it was really like the real gold mines weren't in like, I'm asking my mom a question and she's answering me. It was never like that. It was always in one way or another, I got her to say something emotional and true and honest.
I want to thank Yusuf Saruji for speaking with me. His film Three Promises is opening in New York at the DCTV Firehouse Cinema. See our show notes for details. Thanks to our team, series producer Hannah Nordenswamp, newsletter manager Bella Racklin, and web designer Cross Strategy. Our theme music is composed by Andre Williams, and our executive producer is Rafaela Nehausen. I'm Tom Powers. Follow us on Instagram and sign up for our newsletter at purenonfiction.net.